This is CliffCentral.com. Future CEOs on CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to Future CEOs here on Cliff Central. My name is Gareth Armstrong. It's great to be with you. And week in and week out, what are we doing here on Future CEOs? Well, we try to bring the best and brightest into studio so that we can learn from them because, well, they've done so much in their lives and there's so much to learn from them. Aaron, how do you feel about me saying that, well, we're here to learn from you today and our listeners are listening to learn? Are you a good teacher?
Well, I have some experience as an English teacher, so I have been a teacher.
Oh, really?
And, yeah, it's an honor to be here and have the chance to kind of give my story. And hopefully that story can be educational for people.
Well, that's the voice of Byron Clatterburg, the Chief Executive Officer of CECOM. Yes, the CECOM. And we're so very grateful to have you here in studio with us. As I was rifling through all this, the information that I could find about you, I learned some interesting things. And the first probably best way to introduce you to our community and kick off this conversation is you're a romantic. That's an and I was looking at a number of different things and you're a romantic at heart or in deep inside of you. Do you think that you can probably pinpoint some of the things that I've discovered about you that points toward you being a romantic?
Yeah, I've never thought of myself as a romantic, but I certainly would say I'm a compassionate person. And I'd like to think of myself as a kind person, a person who enjoys philosophy and the greater meanings of life.
Well, maybe that's
romantic.
Coming out. I mean, I came upon a nice little summary of books that you like to read and your favorite books, and some of those titles are The Count of Monte Cristo, for example.
Classic. Yeah.
Master and Commander. I don't think it gets more romantic than that.
Yeah, they're romantic, but they're also really dealing with the complexities of human existence and life, right?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I think also leadership, discipline, having some sort of mission or drive that's greater than yourself.
Mm.
So I think I like those kind of books. I was a history major in school. I don't know if you found that out. So I kind of tend to read historical fiction, and those kind of fall in that category.
So that's a really interesting background. Let's start maybe talk a little bit about your background. You've got a bit of a different history to a potentially traditional CEO type who may be a CA or some kind of business degree. You started in a very different place, and you've also have a number of different environments under your belt, including a lengthy stay in Hong Kong, as I understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I grew up in kind of a quintessential American community in the East Coast of the United States near Washington, D.C.
Mm.
And, you know, all those things of delivering papers and selling seeds and expo tickets as a Boy Scout and raking leaves and shoveling snow. And then went out to Colorado to go to school and worked my way to pay for my living expenses by waiting tables and being a bartender and all those kind of things.
Mm.
So I think, you know, a lot of those experiences are very humbling experiences where you kind of understand the kind of hard work that goes into very relatively what we would think of as mundane tasks, but are actually very important tasks.
Very formative in their nature.
Yeah, and I studied history at school. At that time, this was way back in 1986 when I graduated from university. And at that time, I said, you know, I wanted to study Chinese.
Okay.
And funnily enough, in 1986, I moved to Taiwan to study Mandarin Chinese. And obviously I chose Taiwan because I could work there. Also, they used the traditional Chinese characters in their writing. And since I was a history major, I thought I should learn those. And I could
successfully
work.
Successfully, yes?
Yeah, I think pretty successfully. I spent 3 years there studying Mandarin Chinese. Then when I moved to Hong Kong, which was 89, I was actually working in and out of China. So I traveled all over China. And then worked in China for about 5 years as well.
Okay.
And negotiating joint ventures in Mandarin Chinese. So I think I can still hold my own in Mandarin Chinese.
You also have, as I understand, an MBA from the University of Hong Kong. Is that
correct?
Yeah,
while I was in Hong Kong, I decided I wanted to, you know, I was in business and working in business. And I thought next step for me would be to do a master's. So I did a 3-year executive program at the University of Hong Kong. So.
Often people look at that, an MBA and an MBA experience and I've heard it said that you kind of slap it on your, it's a badge that you kind of boldly and often sometimes overbearingly will throw around. The MBA experience for you, just to those who may be considering that, I mean, what's the real value of an advanced qualification like an MBA?
Yeah, I mean, for me at that time, I was in my 30s. I hadn't started a family yet. It was 9 hours a week of classes, so it was I had to go to class. I think a lot of MBAs today, you can do them online, so you don't have to commit that kind of time and that discipline. But I think that was the first thing. You had to commit the time and the discipline to go to class.
Okay.
Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 6 to 9. And that's a tough one when you're a 30-year-old working guy in Hong Kong and your buddies want to go have beers on Friday nights and you're, I got to go to class first.
Yeah.
But also, I was, you know, the only Caucasian member of my class, so there was that aspect of interacting with Hong Kong students in an English-speaking environment. But I got to know a lot about, you know, and made a lot of friends during that period in the community in Hong Kong. So that was kind of another aspect of it. And certainly, the lecturers, because it was Hong Kong, and Hong Kong is a very international city. You know, you had lecturers from the UK, from Australia, from Hong Kong, from China, from the United States. So it was very international type MBA. And, you know, you get, I think a lot of those things, you get what you put in. And, you know, I learned quite a bit. It was good for me. I was never great in math or finance, and that was it was challenging for me. But, you know, some of the other areas of marketing and human interaction, communication, I was quite good at. But, you know, I felt that the challenging subjects were the ones that helped me, at least.
I don't know if I'm allowed to speak about this marketing thing that you've just raised. We were talking off air about a little stint in marketing. I'm going to do inverted commas marketing, but actually you were a model for a short stint. Are we allowed to talk about that?
Yeah, I shouldn't have brought that up. No, I was in Taiwan and I was an English teacher at the time, and I was studying Mandarin in the mornings, you know, a couple hours a day, and then I would go and work and teach English, and I got approached to be a model, you know, because I said anyone could be a model at that time in Taiwan, so it doesn't mean I'm especially attractive in any way. But I had quite an American look, let's say.
And you said they were trying to sell goods back into Western markets, and so you were their go-to face.
Yeah, that was some of the embarrassing experience there, which was, you know, I went for a photo shoot, and the guy dressed me up in gym clothes that he thought was suitable to market some elbow braces and wrist braces for tennis and knee pads and all these kind of things. And, you know, a year later, I'm walking around in Bethesda, Maryland with one of my high school friends, and we're in a shop, sporting goods shop, and guess whose picture is on the wall? And of course, my friends had a great great laugh about that one. Thank God, in today's age, this was probably in 1988.
Pre-social media.
Yeah, exactly. That would have been posted everywhere, and I would have been very embarrassed. So,
well, could have
good luck
you
trying to find that stuff now. I'm not going to give you the names of the movies or the products.
I will try and avoid searching. But yes, it certainly could have taken you in another direction, but it didn't.
It's a very good experience. Exactly. I mean, I think all these things, you know, whether, you know, as I said, the paper boy when I was growing up, or selling seeds or tickets or waiting tables or bartending or the modeling or even learning another language. Yeah. I think you put yourself in a position that you kind of can understand where other people are coming from and you realize, you know, you kind of open up your mind a bit to other people's perspectives and the challenges they face and how they have to deal with things. You know, and I think maybe that's that romantic thing, but you develop some empathy for people and you start to think, hey, okay, let's understand where they're coming from and how you can work with these kind of different people doing different jobs.
I certainly, after many, many interviews and a fair bit of understanding, the idea or the need for, not the idea, certainly the very real need for an empathetic position, not necessarily sympathetic because that can lead you off in the wrong direction, but an empathetic position or the ability to or skill puts you in a far superior place than some kind of technical skill. And you seem to have gravitated to that kind of thing quite early on. I mean, certainly if you're in a marketing sales environment, human interaction environment. I wanted to quickly ask, before we go too far into your journey, is there a skill, just off the top of your head, is there a skill or ability that you can pinpoint that has taken or brought you as far as you have now come? Just off the top of your head.
Yeah, I guess it would relate to that you know, I don't know if it's a skill. It's certainly an attitude.
Okay.
And it's a positive attitude to kind of being open-minded and being open to new experiences or new ways of looking at things.
Okay.
And then, of course, and I think that does apply to, as you look at a role of a CEO or you try and develop a business, really understanding where the market, where customers are going, where are things headed in terms of trends, and then how do you take that on board and think through all of your options to how do you address going after that market, as an example. I think if you take things with a technical skill or a product view, then you're trying to push something that you want to push into the marketplace or onto people. Whereas I think if you keep your mind open, you kind of think, hey, there's a need out there. How could I develop something that meets that requirement?
What you're saying is very interesting, and I learned quite early on in my career that that confidence, there's a definition for confidence, and that is that confidence, besides all the other softer elements, I was trying to figure out how do you define real confidence? What is it really made of? What's that tangible something? And the definition that I learned, and I've tested over and over again in various different ways, is that confidence is trust in processes that work, which is quite interesting if you begin to pull it apart a little bit. And so what you're describing is the ability to put yourself into someone's shoes as the ability that has brought you as far as you are in your career at this particular stage. Is there a set of processes or a process that you might apply to the ability to be empathetic? I mean, are there two or three steps that you may follow just automatically or subconsciously that you now are being consciously asked to reflect on?
Yeah, I think they're just basic ones of listening as well as maybe communicating. Mm-hmm. So if you think about empathy and trying to understand someone, you have to listen to them first, right? And I think that definition of confidence versus arrogance would be one where confidence is something that's kind of inside you and that allows you the comfort to try and do new things and understand new things. And arrogance is that shell you put over yourself that says, no, I'm not going to listen or look at new ways. I'm right already, and I'm going to put up that shell. And we obviously see that today amongst a lot of leaders globally.
Sure.
And I think there's a very real difference between those two. But I think, listening to people, understanding people, and then that develops empathy, right? And then you can figure out a way to communicate and relate to those people.
What I so appreciate about the answers, and if we had more time, because we've got a lot of questions,
sure.
And there's a lot that you are able to share, but if we had more time, we could probably fall down that rabbit hole, which is, well, how do you develop empathy? You're saying you listen. And then the question, of course, would be, well, how do you actually listen? Because listening is a skill in and of itself. The thoughts of our future CEOs community are reflected back in often conversations that I will have in other environments, and they'll ask, why didn't you ask this question? Why didn't you go further down the rabbit hole? But let's move a little bit along. So you get your MBA at 30 years old or so, is that
31,
correct?
Yeah.
31? 31, yeah. What happens next? Does that send you does it change your trajectory? Does it move you into a different place? What happens after that?
Yeah, at the time, I was doing my MBA. When I started, I was doing some consulting work in China, working for various multinational companies looking to expand in China. And then while I was doing the MBA, I actually joined one of those multinationals in the technology space, an American company, Texas Instruments.
Okay.
And they wanted to move production into China to open up the market in China. So they kind of tied in together with those things. Being kind of a jack of all trades, I managed to, get a job within a technology company based on my language and cultural skills and general business knowledge, et cetera. So I didn't have any technical skill about motor protecting devices or semiconductors, but I did learn as much as you can learn on the job. But I had the cultural knowledge and the business knowledge and the communication and presentation skills. And this was actually forming a joint venture company with a Chinese government-owned entity.
So you're a linchpin of sorts.
Yeah, so I was the guy in the middle trying to bridge the two cultural gaps between a company based in Dallas, Texas, and one based in Baoying, China.
Mm.
So that was quite an interesting role to play. And because it was China, and because at that time, very exciting times, I got to meet very high-level people within the company when I was just a 31, 32-year-old. So that was very lucky for me because it was China. It was the first joint venture in China. China. This was the 80s, 90s, And, you know, very exciting and very precedent-setting for a big company like Texas Instruments at the time. So I got to know some very senior people, and that ended up leading on to my next career somewhat.
Okay.
Which was in telecommunications. So okay. That's how I moved into telecom, was actually from Texas Instruments to a telecoms company.
Yeah, and which is where you are today. As you reflect on that period of your life, I mean, here's a nice, interesting question. And if you were to look at a mistake that you made, that was just pure naivety, What is that mistake that you think you may have made in your career then? And tell us the story. Give us set the context and tell us how this happened.
Yeah, I mean, you make a lot of mistakes, obviously, and you learn from them. Some you don't want to admit to yourself, others you face up to. Yeah, I would say probably I'm quite a energetic person.
Okay.
And therefore get a bit impatient sometimes, you know, and big corporations move slowly.
Yes, they do.
So I encountered some frustration, and instead of being patient and realizing that, you know, the wheels will move and they're moving in the right direction, I got impatient and, you know, we would say spit the dummy, and left the company.
It
wasn't probably in my best interest at the time. I mean, again, things work out and you go down a different path and maybe it's better, maybe it's not. Who really knows, right? You make choices and you move on. But I think I would say I made that choice for the wrong reasons. And I've learned from that, you know, sometimes you need to be a bit more patient, that, you know, you've got a large group of people. A lot of people have opinions. Mm. You've got to listen. You've got to kind of build consensus. You've got to go in a certain direction. Mm. And if you get frustrated by that too easily, then you can just do damage to yourself, right? It's how you interpret what's happening and how you react to what's happening that is key. So,
but what a fantastic lesson given potentially in retrospect, of course, but what a fantastic lesson to learn early on in your career. I think, if I may, can we try and dissect what patience is for just a moment? Because I can hear our listeners saying, but how in the world do you do that? Especially in a fast-paced environment like we are, where machines, the big wheels and the machines of let's call it industry still, they do move slowly, but we've got this juxtaposition, this contrast between the really fast moving digital environment, for example, and these longer decisions that need to be played out, much like you've described now. I mean, what is patience and how do we actually exercise it? How do we, and exercise is, of course, an interesting way to look at it.
No, I would say in today's world with, you know, things being posted online almost immediately, you know, people expect emails to be responded to immediately, you know, phone calls to be answered. You're always online. You're always available. And I think that, you know, I think it's always a challenge for leaders in a business to say, hey, step back. Don't be bombarded and be reactive. You've got to think about what's important. You got to think about which things you need to focus on and your team needs to focus on that are the important stuff. Because I think, you know, today it comes in phone calls, WhatsApp, SMS, email, Facebook posts, you know, you name it, and you get bombarded. And then, of course, you end up just spending your time reacting. And you don't step back and go, hang on a minute, where's the ship going? You know, you're down in the hull trying to fix, you know, a piston screw. Yeah. Meanwhile, the ship's heading for the rocks. So I think you've got to, you know, sometimes step back and you've got to discipline yourself, actually, to be patient, to think, hey, I need this time to distill down some thoughts, look at some things, think bigger picture, think longer term. And, you know, and that pressure, especially on a CEO and on leaders, you know, people want monthly sales numbers. They want quarterly performance numbers. They want annual numbers, right? And we create this environment that is very time constrained without really thinking, you know, what's the mission? What are we trying to do? And what are we trying to offer as a service into the market? And are we improving upon that and doing a better job? And, you know, as I said, a lot of these things take time. And so even you'd have to ask for patience from your shareholders or from your boss. Which is not obviously not as easy as it sounds, but I think that ability to get away from the barrage of that kind of reactive behavior and put yourself in a position where you actually take time, you force yourself to take the time to think about things and think long term.
There's this beautiful French saying that I don't know how to say, so I'm not going to try, but it translates into taking a step back so you can jump higher. And I think that's what I'm hearing you say. But what I also heard you say about patience was that it's a discipline. And it's a discipline that includes a great deal of reflection, but reflection in a particular kind of way. So you're looking forward in a particular kind of way. You're examining your actions now in relation to what you are trying to achieve in the future. And so there's this – thank you. I think you've helped us with figuring out for each of ourselves in our different contexts what patience might be or how to examine it.
Yeah, and I thought you were actually going to bring up a quote that I've used a few times, and I can't remember who said it originally. But it's basically, sorry that I wrote you such a long letter, but I didn't have time to write you a shorter
short
one.
Letter, yeah.
Because I think people get into this verbal, you know, I don't want to use a bad word, but the barrage of information without actually, hey, let's distill that down. And if you actually wanted to say, what are the three bullet point takeaways that are absolutely critical, that actually takes time and effort to discipline yourself to think through that. It's very easy just to write a long treatise on anything, but actually, can you distill it down into the summary? Because that's really what people are going to read and probably understand and accept, and then you have to repeat it to them.
I've worked with someone, a senior executive in a business, the most senior executive, and he didn't read emails. He would read the bullets occasionally, but if he saw something that looked like anything longer than a two or three line paragraph,
email trail,
it's not even going to happen. And he operated operates on his mobile device. And if you think about who you're communicating with as well, you are likely to change the way that you will communicate. But thank you for using that.
Yeah. I think if you take that out, I think you know. Yeah, I get it all the time. You get email chains, and people expect you to read down to the 20th email at the bottom of that chain. And that, you know, I just can't spend that time. So I do need people, and I try and enforce it. You guys need to summarize. What are you asking for? You know, can you provide clarity? Get the key points out. And actually, a lot of people really struggle with that. They just cannot get a grip on it. They'll miss the key points, which is quite surprising, but that's a challenge.
Yeah, it is a challenge. I think it's a challenge of a certain kind of development. Especially in an age where there's so much information and you can pull out so much. But that's why you pay people to do certain jobs and you have expectations on them. Let's talk about not necessarily your pay, but the jobs that then you were called to do as you've risen to this point of the CECOM CEO. What was next? So you joined a telecommunications business after you were with – I think you said Texas Instruments.
Texas Instruments, yeah, that's right. And then I left Texas Instruments and joined a company called British Telecom, BT. And this was a big time of change for BT. And at that time, BT, I was in Hong Kong in their Asian headquarters, and BT was looking to expand and invest in Asia. And I just completed this joint venture and a few other licensing operations in China for Texas Instruments. So they thought, want to get into China? This guy seems to know how to set up JVs and work with technology companies. It's going to be a good fit. And it just so happened that the CEO at the time of BT was an ex-Texas Instruments guy.
Okay.
Well, so, you get an introduction, you get a name, okay, it helps.
But to your point earlier, which is you were able to, I'm going to use the word hobnob a little bit, but mix and build relationships with some senior executives, I think, early on, to your point.
Yeah, well, I think, I was lucky in the sense that in 1980 – six, when I graduated university, this was 86. China was not exactly on people's radar, really. It had just opened up some special economic zones. It was still a very poor and backward and rural country. The manufacturing waves hadn't hit, all of that infrastructure hadn't been built. So taking a punt and saying, I'm going to go learn Mandarin Chinese in 1986, I'm not saying no one was doing it, but it was kind of a step that was...
Yeah, it was the path.
Led me on a path, so to speak. And because of that, then I got some opportunities, I would say.
So on that particular point, did you do that with some form of strategy in mind, or was it you as a young person just saying, I want to go and learn Chinese, I want to go and learn Mandarin, I want an Eastern experience? Or did you see in the back of your mind – Are you saying that you really did see the opportunity?
Yeah, maybe a little bit of the opportunity.
Okay.
Because at that time, I think Japan was actually the big upcoming, you know, in America at that time, you know, all the talk was about the Japanese are taking over and they're buying buildings and golf courses and everything, right? And I was studying martial arts at the same time I was going to university. So I did think about Japan. But then I kind of thought, well, you know, I talked to some of my professors and they said, well, you know, really, when you get down to it, you know, if you really want to understand Asia and all the influences in Asia, and really North Asia, but then you need to understand China and, you know, and the Chinese language and the influence of the Chinese language and thought and philosophy on all of the other major Asian nations, mostly, if you talk about North Asia.
Mm.
So that's how it kind of panned out. I think I, on the one hand, I was fascinated by when one of my college professors wrote a Chinese character on the blackboard, and he wrote the character for Dao, and Dao Ke Dao. And I thought, that's their language? So it's a picture, and it has all this meaning, and it can mean all these different things.
Yeah,
and that's when they hit in their head, they think, with that picture in their head, they don't have an alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
And that just kind of – and I asked him, and you learned this language? And he said, yeah, I lived in Taiwan for 5 years, you know, did my PhD in Chinese. And I was just amazed that that could happen, that, you know, here's a bearded Caucasian guy saying, hey, he's absolutely fluent, can read ancient Analect texts of Confucians in Chinese.
Mm.
And so I was just, wow, blown away.
Oh, yeah, so it was just coming together, these two worlds.
Yeah, okay. So I thought, you know, let's go and explore it. And, I arrived in Taiwan with a backpack and a one-way ticket with no real knowledge of what was going to happen, you know. So it was a little scary, but, you know, it's funny. You're scared and you're nervous and you're thinking, how do I even get downtown? You know, how do I find – I had an address for another student I could look up. But, of course, this was before mobile phones, emails, and all that stuff. Mm. So I got a piece of paper with the address in English, and I'm walking around Taipei. Does anyone know where 25 Wen Jiao Street is? And people are looking at me like, what? I managed to find it, you know, and everything just works out, you know.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Of course, you're nervous, you're scared, but it all works out.
But, yeah, that's part of the adventure.
Yeah.
Let's move it along a little bit. And you find yourself in some leadership positions as you're growing in your career now. The interesting question that we used to ask, we don't really ask it too much anymore because I think it's become quite obvious, and we recount it rather than ask the question, is how much of your career has been spent or used on a technical understanding and the ability to technically execute somewhere, and that was in the first phase of your career. I'm sorry, I'm not asking this very well. Mm. And then later on in your career, it seems to change. But in your case, the answer is always technical, and then people here at the other end. Which, so in a leadership environment, you're dealing with people. You're not really dealing with technical that much. It could be done below even 40% of the job that you do. Is that your experience? I mean, you're in a technical environment.
Yeah, I'm in a technical environment, and I joined BT without any understanding of telecommunications as such. But I leveraged some, you know, cultural knowledge and some general business knowledge and China experience to get into telecoms. And of course, you know, set my mind to learn as much as I could. And again, I was fortunate that I was involved in the kind of mergers and acquisitions side of BT, which again is quite high profile. So I got a bit, you know, again, put myself in a position where I didn't have to know exactly how an SMS was sent from China to the UK, or how you bill, or all these technical, or how they interface and recognize phone numbers, and, you know, all the technology that goes in. But I could understand the business, the number of users, revenue, you know, how much, you know, so from a commercial and business perspective and a market perspective, you can understand how that technology can be applied. And I think that carries forward, you know, after 20 years in the telecoms industry, I certainly understand, you know, one would say I specialize in data transmission networks, right? CECOM is all about building the African internet. I'm not an expert on internet protocol. You know, I understand the hardware suppliers and all that, but when you get down to actually building the infrastructure and then delivering a service, we're really a service company. We're becoming more and more a service company. So does the manager of the hotel have to understand how the floor polishers operate? And you'd say, no, he doesn't. Right? He doesn't need to know how to cook the chicken with spinach. But he knows service, and he knows from the customer experience, what is that experience going to be, and how do you organize people to deliver that experience? The technology is just one part of it. I think actually, you know, there's lots of companies that can lead in technology but fail in the marketplace.
Yep,
there's no question about it.
Yep.
And there's certainly companies that have, you know, focus on a product or a technology that they like, but it's not really meeting a market requirement. And then, you know, the classic story of the marketing myopia, where it's the railways who, you know, improve their trains and the service on the trains, and the seats are better on the trains and blah, blah, blah. But actually people start flying.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and you miss the point. Yeah, so, yeah. Exactly. So, and I think that still happens today, right? People get caught in the technology, and then, you know, it's, we've yet to see whether a lot of the kind of cloud service provider type companies, can they sustain themselves really, right? They're relatively new if you think about it. And, you know, you see the somewhat, we look at the demise of the large corporates of the past and the advent of these new companies and the way they do things. But are they going to be around in 100 years?
Yeah.
You know, even 50 years? We don't know at this point.
And I think what seems to have happened is that we have moved away from even wanting to build companies for that period of time. We just, there seems to be these 5-year entry and exit strategies that are now developed. And so no one, often people then don't build the right type of entities in the right way with the right values and the right outlook.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think there's a lot of, well, there's money looking for a home. So there's money out there, you know, big money, mm-hmm. looking for the next, you know, technological advance or next new service or app, you know, and more. And there's people who want to sell that story, but is it really a sustainable value add to our society? Mm. And is that really going to continue forward and create a viable business? And again, the jury's still out on a few of those.
Right? Well, what I'm picking up from you is a little bit of pessimism around that. Are you happy to explore that a little bit?
I think the pessimism is around that, you know, just by having technology or having that a certain specific skill or knowledge that you can succeed over the longer term.
Mm.
You know, I think what I've learned and, you know, talking about patience and all these things are that even you, what you see in economies and what you see as at a country level or within a corporate environment, things take time, mm. right? And the things you do this year will affect you 2 years from now, you know? And I think, you know, a lot of these kind of startups that we were just talking about are, it's got to be quick. You got to show a quick return, right? Some are longer term investments. And I think, again, some you would say inherently offer a value. They mm-hmm. offer a solid value proposition and they've changed a market dramatically.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think those companies will continue to succeed if they mm-hmm. continue to invest and develop serving that market requirement. I guess I was speaking about some of the other ones which come up with something, you know, ridiculous. What was it? The water kettle that's connected to your internet that you know, whatever. I mean, there's things that go a little too far, right?
Sure.
And you think that's not really offering much value.
Yeah. The certainly in the world now that you're just saying that in this Internet of Things thing that we're seeing, there is some ridiculousness out there, which is it's also fun to watch.
Yeah, it's fun to watch. And I think if you step back from it, you think, you know, what that could mean, right? Mm. And how that gets applied into smart cities, traffic congestion, you know, sanitation. There's all kinds of good applications. A lot of those are probably things that the government needs to kind of work with private industry to develop. But there's obviously a lot of little private industry trying to pop up and find some money and make a quick buck if you look at it that way.
So I think I started this part of our conversation by speaking about the difference between the skill set that's necessary to be a technical operator and then to be a leader in a certain kind of environment. The people skills are high there, but do you ever get frustrated with either a lack or too much technical ability, and how do you deal with that within your team?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, that would probably be the next most important thing is that you need to build a team around you that kind of, you know, supports and augments your capabilities, right? So I think having a strong technical person and a strong technical team that can help deliver the vision and what you're trying to achieve is very important. So, yeah, you've got to surround yourself with the right people, the right finance people, the right marketing people, the right sales people, you know, all these functions. Can you get so people are motivated, they understand where you want to try and go, and they know what they need to do?
Okay, so but how do you do this? So you've said augment some of your skills and abilities, but how do you find the right people? The right people is the word that is needs emphasis, I think.
I mean, it'd be great if you could start up a company and, you know, have a blank slate, so to speak.
Mm.
And build it, but that poses its own challenges. But I think that's very rare. I think generally speaking, I've come into companies where I've had a job and I've been put in charge of people. I had no, say in choosing those people, but I had to work with them, right? And I had to get the best out of them. I've come into other jobs where I had to build a team. I'm the first guy, and within 2 years, we have 200 people under me. So, you know, there you can choose, and sometimes you choose badly. You know, that's the reality of, you know, you're not always going to be right when you choose. And sometimes you'll inherit a team and find out, hey, you've got some great people here. So I think it's really how you put those people to use, so to speak, in terms of making sure they're clear on what they need to do. They're motivated. You know, they want to come in and perform their role and contribute to the greater good. I mean, I think that's the key. Mm-hmm. And I think you can, you know, you can, I use a lot of military analogies or naval analogies.
Yeah, please do.
Right. And you mentioned some of the books I like to read, and I like that because I think, you know, in a lot of those military or naval situations, you have somebody comes in and he's got to now captain that ship.
Mm.
He can't say, get rid of all the midshipmen, all the lieutenants, and all of the men on board and change them out.
Mm.
Right? It's not going to happen.
Mm.
He's got to actually mold that team into something. And I think we've seen time and time again that there are the right kind of charismatic leaders who can take whatever you give them, and they can turn it into something better.
But how
and
do you?
I think that is that's the challenge, right? And that's why we say great leaders, right? And I think that, you know, if you look at history and you think about some of the commonalities of some of those people we would consider incredible leaders, people who've changed, you know, whether you're Julius Caesar, Napoleon, mm-hmm. or Genghis Khan, you know, it's, I think a lot of that goes back to our first conversation about empathy, mm-hmm. right? These are not guys who keep themselves aloof. These are guys who go have dinner with the men, who eat what they're eating, and they go down and they understand really what makes them tick. And I think that is the fundamental difference, or that has made the difference in them coming up and being who they are and able to lead the way they have led.
The best, I think you can call it treatise of sorts, that I've read on the difference between management and leadership is that, and the key difference is that leaders delight the rank and file. They're able to connect. They do. They walk with them. They go to, I mean, just thinking about a Napoleon who was well documented that he would go and visit after a battle the individuals that were sick and ill, and then this is what he would do. He wouldn't just let them go into a medical tent and do whatever they needed to do there. I wanted to ask you, though, sticking with the potential the naval theme, which is, and it's a question of mutiny. Have you ever faced, and you don't have to go into all the detail, but I think there's key lessons to learn from someone that has faced mutiny or the threat of mutiny. And how have you dealt with that in your careers and teams?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, mutiny is a strong word. I think certainly
in a
corporate
word.
Environment, certainly you have, you know, the water cooler gossip and the people who, you know, are unsatisfied or dissatisfied or believe that things could be done better or differently. Mm. And you always get that, right? Mm. And so you can't, you know, overly take that to heart, right? I think you've got to always, again, step back and think of the big picture, right? And I think in today's society, you know, you read all the time in the news now about, you know, tweet responses. So mm-hmm. they take the sample of four people and they say, oh, there's been negative, and you're like, four people mm-hmm. out of, you know. So while you always hear that negative and it gets, you know, posted and reported on, that really doesn't give you the real gauge of really what's happening. And mm-hmm. I think as a leader, you've got to just kind of ignore the noise, right? You got to ignore the people who are, you know, fawning on you with false praise as much as you have to have the naysayers.
Mm.
You know, generally I don't like, and I think most leaders don't like, you know, negativity.
Sure.
So I think that is just something you need to, you know, you need to have optimism. You need to have confidence. You know, if you don't buy into the story or you think things could be done better, then bring it up and let's try and fix it. Don't just complain.
Mm.
But that's a challenge just because, you know, corporations and companies are made up of people. And people, that's just a natural thing. And some people are more inclined to complain and to moan. I don't know if they'll mutiny. I mean,
sure.
I've never been in a situation where people actively sabotaged, you know,
yeah,
or
yeah.
tried to, you know.
That's why it is very strong. You know, sure,
put me overboard with, you know, like Captain Bligh.
Yeah.
But, you know, also you never wanted to get to that point,
mm.
right? So if you look at the mutiny on the Bounty, a famous naval example, how did it get that far? Right. You'd have to ask the question. There was obviously not enough communication going on between, well, Lieutenant Bligh, who wasn't a captain, and his first officer and the men. So obviously he misread the situation because he wasn't communicating with them.
Yep. And to your point of, and you said ignore, but I know what you mean. You don't mean just shut it off or
no,
shut
you,
it
you
out.
No, you can't shut it out.
You allow it to come in. You need to absorb it, but you need to have a thick skin and not allow it to affect you, but be dialed in enough to be able to understand when enough is enough. I think that's what I've heard you say.
Yeah, and I think certainly I think most people, maybe me because I'm that romantic, you know, one person criticizing me hurts me more than 10 people praising me, just because I always think I hear the negativity I get sensitive to it. So it does affect you. So I'm not saying you ignore it. I'm just saying you got to take it and step back and go, hang on a minute. You know, what are the 90% of the things that we're doing right? And then, okay, yes, we've got this 10% problem. Yes, we can improve it. Mm. You know, but I've never worked anywhere or been any part of any organization where you've got 100% of everything working perfectly.
Sure.
You know, if you want to, you know, reach that nirvana, someday maybe you will, but I just don't think it really exists. I think you have to be able to deal with the fact that, you know, if you can get 90% right, you're in great shape.
Well, you're in really great shape.
Yeah. But you can get 80% right, you're in great shape.
The CEO of, I forget which business it was, I can see his name, Graham, his face. He said, if you get 50% of all your decisions right, you're going to be in a really, really great place. And I thought 50%, that seems so low, but really, 50% is pretty good.
Yeah, and I think the same would be said of even people do, you know, engagement surveys of the entire corporate staff. How engaged are people? Are people committed and involved? And, you know, if you can get above 50%, you're also doing great. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, the idea of, you know, if you've got 50 to 60% of people really committed, dedicated, want to do the right thing, that's fantastic. Mm. You're always going to get, you know, people who are negative. It's just sometimes people's character, sometimes maybe be personal things going on.
Mm.
You know, generally speaking, those people don't rise up in an organization just because no one wants to, you know, it's just a natural thing. You don't want to be around negativity if you're trying to do something.
And there's this churn that happens as well. Your three, I want to just ask some, maybe just a few quick fire questions before we run out of time here. And I'll start with your three pillars of CEO leadership. What are those?
Yeah, I have none. I would not be able to tell you what the three pillars are. I mean, I came in as the CEO of CECOM. It was 3 years ago, more than 3.5 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, the challenge with the CEO role, and people generally speaking think of the CEO role, they think you're the top of the pyramid, so to speak, right? And as far as the corporate structure that you're in,
An organogram.
But actually, you're kind of stuck between your shareholders, you know, and there's, we have four main ones and kind of one of them shared, so five, and they all have their different views. And, you know, going from having one boss who probably knew your industry and, you know, you could relate to on a personal level, now all of a sudden you're stuck between having, you know, eight direct reports in the organization below you and having, you know, 10, 16 above you. Those, you know, the pillars of wisdom have to go both ways, so to speak. So you can look at leadership and the things we talked about, the captain of the ship, but actually that captain is part of a fleet, right? And pretty soon
he's got an admiral.
You know, he's got an admiral. If he's lucky, he's got one admiral, right? But he might have, you know, six admirals, right?
Yeah.
If he has six admirals, then he's going to have trouble. I mean, I'm just saying that chain of command would say you've got only one kind of boss, so to speak. So I think in the CEO role, I think the pillar, and I think because of that, it is very much about a communication, personal dynamic that you need to develop so that you get the trust of the people above you and keep them informed at the right level. And that's why you need to write that short letter, because board members aren't going to be in my business every day. They're going to meet quarterly for a board meeting. So you got to manage that, you know, and you hope to get them to pay attention, and you have to be engaging to communicate the key points to them, which is quite tricky. And then you have to do the same going down to your team, right? You don't want, you know, each guy who has his functional responsibility must know what's expected of him for his role and responsibilities, but also how he coordinates with others, right? Mm. Is very true in military situations, or go back to your naval examples. You know, you can't have the guy with the bazooka doing whatever he wants. He's a great bazooka shooter, but, you know, meanwhile the riflemen are climbing up the hill where he's aiming. You know, you have to say, guys, we need to work together. So you've got to provide that basic information, but I want you to understand the objective, know what you need to do, and then coordinate with each other. And that's not as easy as it sounds, certainly.
Just a point of experience here. I worked as a consultant for a few years for a small consultancy, and we found and this is not going to be strange information to you, but we learned that there, in many operations, that the core issue there was the flow of information.
Hmm.
And so that there was this cement middle or something that existed between senior executives, senior management, and the rest of this junior team who were probably often technical operators. How do you deal with that in your business? How do you make sure that you're actually getting the information? So you're talking about being succinct and being precise about information, but how do you get the real stuff out?
Yeah, and that's a challenge because that's a balance between what you're getting told and what you're seeing in reports. So and what you're hearing, you know, by walking the halls and talking to people. Right, we're a small company, so at CECOM, you know, we have the ability that we're kind of, you know, we're small enough that I know pretty much everyone's name and I kind of know what everyone does, and we kind of can communicate, right? Everyone says that I've got an open door policy, but does it, you know, I think it's more than that. You can't just wait for people to come to you. You got to go out and speak to them, right? Mm. And understand where they're coming from and actually listen. So I think, you know, you've got all this barrage of information. You got reports, you got technical data, you might have usage data, you might have financial data. Then you get feedback from people and emotions, right? And they can scupper everything. So I think it's equally as important to say, let's make sure we're all agreed. You know, even if we have a dispute, at the end of the day, we say, okay, we've agreed that this is the way we're going to go forward. And sometimes you have to set timelines so that people say, okay, we're going to try this for 6 months. If it doesn't work, we're going to come back again, sit down and review it again. Mm. And generally speaking, you know, 6 months comes and yes, we're on the right track and we're going to keep going on this track. Mm. But yeah, it's, you know, filtering all those pieces of information and emotion, right? Not just information.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? You've said filter. Filter then leads me into the next question, which is, what is the worst advice you've ever received? And I wonder how you'd filter it. But the worst advice you've received through your career.
Yeah, boy. I've never really thought about that. I can't think of any worst advice I've ever received.
That's a really good position to be in.
I mean, I think, you know, certainly I've received lots of advice.
Absolutely. Right?
And I think, you know, maybe in my personality and character, I take it on, I listen, and I see is it valid or not.
Test it,
you know. But I wouldn't, you know, so that I wouldn't say that's the worst. I would never take someone's advice and go, yeah, that's it, I'm gonna do that. That's unlikely, right?
Okay.
So I wouldn't say, oh, I did it and look what happened. You know, it was a train smash. You know, normally I'd say, hey, let me take that advice, and I'm going to go ask five other guys what they think, and then I'm going to go run it by the team that's going to implement it, and they're going to, you know, tell me. And by the time I get there, that probably advice has changed, right? Because I think everybody has a view, right? Everyone has a view. You distill it down, and then maybe that's that filtering. Really, right?
Okay, well, good. No, fantastic. Thank you. Great answer. Then I don't know if we're going to get an answer out of you here on this one. What's the best advice you've ever received?
Yeah, that would probably be patient. Yeah?
Okay. Yeah, that's what we've discussed earlier. Be patient. Was that received in a moment? Of course, it was probably received in a moment of impatience. But was it received in a moment where you could acknowledge that advice, or is that retrospective?
Nah, that was long time ago advice. You know, I probably, as I said, that mistakes, you know, things you do and you realize that, you know, I think by nature, people, when, especially when they're excited and motivated and they think things are going well and everything's, people want to get their ideas out and they want to implement and get it moving and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, you're working in an organization with lots of people who have lots of opinions. And so you got to make sure that you kind of take time to, you know, I always think it's like a big ship. If you want to change direction, it's not, you can't just turn on a dime. You have to actually gradually get people working together to bring that ship around. And some people, you know, still get impatient. And I think when you get a little more experienced, it just naturally comes. I think this comes from, you know, being a father, from, you know, daily life, that you have to be patient, right? Mm. And you have to accept listening to something. Maybe you don't agree with right away, but you can't cut it off because that's going to offend that person. So you be a bit more patient and think through and distill. Sometimes, you know, I think people, we react again too fast. I even make myself disciplined. If I think something is, I'm reacting, I will stop, put that email or hold off on that phone call for a day and sleep on it and think about it. And then usually I change my mind, I would say. So that says something, right? Mm. I think that usually I'll go, ooh, let me tone that down and take a different approach than a reactive, you know, that could be anger, it could be frustration, it could be an emotion that's probably not a positive emotion in the situation, and you just have to kind of step back from it and take a bit of time, and usually that will actually change your position. Mm. And I think we're seeing that today, obviously, in the world where things are, you know, tweeted out, or there's reactive, you know, immediate reactive instead of distillation and analysis and thought given to something.
And that's on both sides of the coin. I mean, I'm just thinking of your classic U.S. example, I'm afraid, in leadership. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're easy to identify and easy to see. But I truly do feel like it's on both sides of that fence.
Certainly. I think it's almost like stirring up reaction, right? And it's not good either side.
Yeah.
I think, you know, when you think like a country or a company, when you want to do the best thing, what is the objective we're trying to get to? What's the best way to get to that objective? And it's going to involve a lot of things, but you would think it's going to involve some analysis, right? Have we done this in the past? What's been the result? Have other countries done this, or other companies done this? What's the result? You know, and think through that. And I think that's kind of what we seem to be missing, because I think we're get tied up in this immediacy, in reaction. And I think that's part of the problem, right?
I've learned, as we've discussed, and it's probably the key thing that I'm going to take out of this conversation today. And that is that in spite of it all, in spite of everything that you are dealing with on a day-to-day basis, what you need to be is disciplined enough, or have the ability to, which is then discipline, to be able to step back and stop and take on board, review, analyze what we've just been speaking about. And it seems like this is something that you have been able to master, and which has allowed you, so going back to that question of what's the ability. And so I try and learn in these kind of conversations. And so it seems that your ability is not necessarily communication or empathy, but your true ability is discipline.
Could be. I'm not sure if I've mastered that. Certainly it's something I think about, and I recognize and say it's something I need to manage, right? Mm. Because first thing in the morning, you wake up and you're, you know, still half asleep, and people are checking emails. Okay, I can't, you know, I got to stop doing that. I'll read through them, and then I'll go in the office and I'll deal with them. Mm. So I'll see if there's anything that's urgent, you know, like if we have a network issue or something like that. But if it's not, let me give it some thought. Mm. But I think that, you know, there's a lot of people out there almost in addiction to that immediate reaction. Mm. And it's hard to control it sometimes, right? Mm. Because we're always on. We're always, you know. So I try to make sure the phone is, you know, off at meal times. I don't put the phone on the table at dinners or lunches. I don't, you know, I try to, you know, separate that time so you can have better quality time, and then do those things separately. I do that with the family, and I do that with people that I interact with, just because I just, you know, I find that having the triple distraction, or, you know, all these phone calls and what people texting or looking at their email while they're having a meeting, it's just, it's not a good use of time.
Well, certainly. I mean, that's the disengagement that we are we were talking about earlier, which is hugely counterproductive to anything happening.
I think for some reason, I don't know exactly why, but for some reason there seems to be emails, WhatsApps, or phone calls are more important than the person in front of you, which is just a strange situation. And your example of the other CEO who doesn't answer emails, I think, you know, that's some discipline there, right? Because I think people, for whatever reason, seem to prioritize that. Like, you'll be sitting at a lunch, the phone will ring, the person will answer the phone, and you think, well, I'm here with you having lunch. Why does this person calling you at lunchtime get priority over me?
Yeah, you know? Yeah, agreed. And as you were saying that, I was glancing at my computer screen.
I didn't want to comment. Let me hang on. Let me.
But it has been a fascinating conversation.
My phone has been in my pocket the whole interview.
Mine as well. But thank you. I think because we're literally have a minute left here almost, and I so appreciated this conversation, and I was just looking quickly through and thinking, have we touched on everything that you can add? But I think you've offered us something that is invaluable, to me. And it is that conclusion around discipline, around the ability to take a step back. And so for that lesson, I thank you, and I thank you on behalf of our future CEOs community. And thank you for taking the time to be with us. And we look forward to seeing how CECOM rises to the challenges that are out there in the world and with you at the helm. And you know, we're excited and grateful. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was great to be here. Very interesting discussion. And I think, I think the proof's in the pudding. I mean, right, it's easy to become CEO. Maybe not easy, but you can become a CEO. I guess the question, can you sustain it? Can you year after year perform and grow your business and provide a service and provide value into the marketplace? I hope we're on the right track. I think we're on the right track. And we'll see. I mean, I think that's, you know, can we stand the test of time?
Well, we'll be watching on with great interest. So thank you again. That's Byron Clatterback, the Chief Executive Officer of CECOM. And that's all we have time for today on Future CEOs. A really valuable conversation, especially for us young, sometimes probably obnoxious, sometimes a little bit impatient types that want to get things done. But we need discipline. We need patience. We need to be able to see the future and be smart about the decisions that we make. We will see you same time, same place with some more interesting insights from CEOs and other leaders next week. See you then.
Future CEOs on CliffCentral.com.